Good evening. My name is Juanita, and I'm a very, very incredibly grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon.
Hi, Juanita.
I want to thank you all for coming to this incredible event. I thought there were less of you up here than what I see right now, and I was doing okay. Isaiah, thank you. You helped me get balanced. I needed your story to just calm me down because I just was a little uptight here. And Kateri, I want to thank you for having Lila here. You know, Al-Anon is a family program, and that includes our little ones. You know, I don't know about your family, but in my family, the little ones are the ones who suffered the most. And I was one of the ones who caused the most pain to some of our little ones because I was not emotionally available to them. I gave them all the food and the shelter and kept them clean. They had a bed to sleep in. But emotionally, I wasn't there. So when I see our little ones, our children, our babies come into our meetings of Al-Anon, I can't tell you how it fills my heart because I hope that maybe there's a family and there's children who are not going to have the torment that I grew up with and the torment that I put my children through. My name is Juanita, and I stand before you as a woman who is not the woman who showed up in the meeting room of Al-Anon on July 2nd of 1986. I am a completely different person, completely different. This is not the way I intended to start out. In fact, I don't know how I intended to start out. All I know is that I was nervous as you know what. You know, Bud told me he was going to go share at Minnesota at the Gopher State Roundup. And I thought, oh man, I've been there. I did that like 12 years ago. And there's like 7,800 people at this conference there. And they put your face up on these huge things, you know. And this is what it kind of feels like, you know. We got some members down there, you know? So I feel like, ooh, you know, I mean, like they care, right? Like the bars down there, like they're going to listen, right, to a family member. You know what I'm saying? All they've ever heard is wah, 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 wah. So anyway, I have no idea where this talk is going. I'll tell you that I asked God to, this is what I asked. And this is my prayer. And this is my prayer every time that I have the privilege to speak to either members of Al-Anon or members of Alcoholics Anonymous or both. And my prayer is, God, please, I ask that you open up my heart as wide open as can possibly be. And I ask that you open up my spirit as wide open as could possibly be. And I ask you that you open my mind up as wide open as could possibly be, so that the thoughts that I need to get from you to convey the words that I need to convey to the people are here, that I'm present for. I will tell you that in coming here before this, I was very nervous, and the reason I was very nervous, and this isn't the first time that I've been asked to share my story with people of the Native culture. You know, the first time I ever did it was, I don't know, about 22, 23 years ago in Ignacio, Colorado at the Indians in Sobriety, and that was actually the first time that I ever participated in the Sweat Lodge. And my husband and I fell in love with that. And the next couple of years, I was asked to be, I was telling Shirley, I was asked to come and speak at the Trail of Tears in Oklahoma. And what an honor that was. And the reason I was so nervous about doing this here is because, well, I have Native blood. I don't have ownership of the specific heritage. I can't say that I'm this, I can't say that I'm that, you know? It's every time a Native person meets me, one of the first things that they say, is, what tribe are you from? What pueblo are you from? And I say, I don't know. And immediately their eyes kind of glaze over and they kind of look beyond me. And so I have this, we've had workshops this weekend about shame and guilt, and I will tell you that I have experienced shame and guilt from not knowing what my heritage is, because I know there's Native American blood in my family. My father would say, and I never know if he was joking, because he always said it with this little smile on his face, "We're Cherokee from Oklahoma, you know." And my mother wouldn't own up to it. And none of my aunts and uncles on my mother's side will own up to it. You know, but if you take a look at us, especially my mother and her family, I mean, they look even more Native than I do, you know, and that's pretty Native. So I don't know what to say, you know. So when we talk about shame and guilt about growing up in an alcoholic family, I've had to overcome the shame and guilt of speaking in a setting like this, because I feel like I don't have ownership of my exact heritage. Now, the funny thing is, I was talking to Don a few days ago. We were on the phone, and, you know, we were talking about the program and who we were going to get to do. And I said, "Do you know any of these people?" Because I will tell you that a month ago, we had 40 people registered for this event. 40 people. And we thought, oh, man, we're going to blow it. And I always thought, well, we still have an out. We can just cancel. And then immediately I remembered that we had a contract with this hotel, so there was no canceling. I mean, we were in this, you know, hook, line, and sinker. So it's like we had to do this. So we have this huge program that we've put together for you, but we have no idea who we're going to get to lead it. So I'm talking to Don. I said, "Don, who are we going to get? Do you know any of these people?" And he gave me a few names. He gave me Mary, gave me Sparrow, he gave me a few other people. And he said, "Why don't you do this one?" I said, "Don, I really think that we need a Native person." And he goes, "You should do this." And I said, "Yeah, but..." And he said, "Come on," he said, "you talk like a Native, you walk like a Native, you think like a Native, you move like a Native, you look like a Native." He said, "Why don't you just own it?" I'm going to own it. When I came into Al-Anon, it was shame and guilt. Shame and guilt. You see, my first language was Spanish. I spoke only Spanish till I was 5 years old. When my mom went to sign me up for kindergarten, she told the teacher, "She can't speak English, but she understands it." Well, that was about the end of my Spanish speaking at home or any place else, because when you're indoctrinated into everybody else speaks English, that's what you speak, and you quit speaking whatever language you have at home. And my grandparents, I'm one of the only grandchildren that my grandparents have. In fact, I am the only grandchild that my grandparents had that spoke Spanish. None of the other ones spoke Spanish because they were too ashamed and too embarrassed. And when I got into the rooms of Al-Anon, not only, even though I knew I had Native American blood in me, but which everybody in my family denied, but I also denied or wanted to deny the fact that I had Hispanic blood in me, because I was ashamed of it. I was so ashamed of it. I grew up believing that it was the white people, the Anglos as we call them here in New Mexico. The Anglos were the ones who knew and who had it all together, and they were the smart ones. They were the ones who worked hard and had the money, and I and my family were all second-class people. So I had a lot of shame and guilt, not only of growing up in a family where there was active alcoholism, but also the fact that not only was I Hispanic, but also that there was this Indian blood that nobody wanted to talk about. Nobody wanted to talk about. As far as everybody in my family was concerned, it did not exist. One of the first things in working the steps that happened to me was that I claimed my Hispanic heritage. And I've heard so many of you here this weekend say, stand up in front of the podium or in our meetings up here and say, I'm Navajo and I'm Hispanic. I'm this and I'm Hispanic. I'm this and I'm Mexican. I got Mexican Indian in me. You know, I thought that there was something wrong with me. I really believed with all my heart, my soul, that there was something so bad wrong with me. I didn't realize that it all began with alcoholism. And it began with alcoholism. Alcoholism goes back so far in my family on both sides. My grandparents, their grandparents. You know, my father wouldn't even talk about his childhood. All I knew about my dad's childhood was that he was in the fields at the age of 4, weeding, doing the things he had to do to help with the family farm. My grandpa, on my mom's side, He had this farm, and he called what we called a field where he grew all his vegetables and stuff, and we called it the milpa. And Grandpa had the milpa that he was out there working in all the time. And then he also had, you know, the chickens and the goats and the turkeys. And I mean, that was my grandpa. And my grandma on my dad's side, I remember being 5 years old. And I'd spend the night at my grandma's house. And she had this little adobe house. And this is in the valley of Pohuake. Some of you know where Pohuake is. And it's just about 16 miles north of Santa Fe here in northern New Mexico. And I would wake up at my grandma's house in this little adobe house. And she had about 5-6 rooms in this adobe house, but she only used 3 of them. She used her kitchen, and she used the middle room, and she used the first bedroom there. The other two were still unfinished adobes and still unfinished floor. In fact, all the floors were unfinished. They were dirt. They were hard-packed dirt, adobe dirt. That was my grandma's house. And she heated the whole house with wood stoves, and she cooked on a wood stove. I'll tell you, my grandma made the best tortillas and beans and fried potatoes on that wood stove. Oh, man, I could salivate just thinking about my grandma's cooking, you know? I mean, I remember getting those fresh tortillas and putting butter on them, and oh, it was the best. And grandma didn't have running water in her house. We had to go out to the well, and she didn't have indoor plumbing. We had to go to the outhouse at grandma's. You know, and I'd wake up in the morning at grandma's house, and she'd go, oh, mijita, she said, you're awake, she said, you want some coffee? And I'd say, oh, yeah, grandma, I want some coffee. And, of course, coffee with grandma was mostly milk and a little bit of coffee in there, you know, and that was it. And she'd give me a little galletita, a little biscuit, a little sweet biscuit. And maybe some of my friends here know what I'm talking about, but that was breakfast at grandma's. And then she'd say, okay, mija, now we got to go for water. So we'd go and we'd walk like the 50, 70 yards or whatever to the well. And grandma would get the pail off the hook, and she'd help me put it over the edge. And you could tell when it hit because it just went slack in the water, you know. And then you'd let it fill up. And then she'd say, let's pull it up now. And we'd pull, and she'd help me pull because it's awfully heavy, the bucket of water, you know. And I was so excited. I can't tell you how excited I was at grandma's house pulling up that bucket, you know, because you never knew what you were going to get besides the water, you know. And if you've ever gone to a well and had to draw up your water like that, sometimes there's a little water spider in there. I remember one time we had a little teeny tiny sapo, a little frog in that bucket. And that was so exciting to me. It really was. I mean, at my house, you turned on the faucet and you got water, you know. I mean, at grandma's, it's like, it was an adventure, you know. Everything was an adventure. And so that, for me, at the age of 4 and 5, life was exciting. Oh my gosh, life was so, so exciting. And you see, I stand here with you guys and my accent starts to come out. You know, I mean, I just can't help it. You know, in another setting, you wouldn't even know, but I'm here with you and I'm listening to all the different accents this weekend and it's just like, I can't help it. It's like we have a house in Nashville, Tennessee, and before I know it, after we've been there like 3 weeks, I'm talking like with a little southern accent. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what it is. Anyway, so I was like, had this sense of anticipation about life. You know, it was just exciting. Life was exciting. Life was, oh man, I can hardly wait to see what's going to happen next. What's going to be next? What's this day going to bring? But living with active alcoholism one day at a time living with active alcoholism, what happened was that sense of excitement, that sense of anticipation slowly left me. Day at a time, that sense left me. And what I was left with was a sense of shame, a sense of keep your mouth shut. You don't tell anything that happens in this house. Don't you dare repeat this. I don't want to hear that you've been talking to your aunts and uncles even about the stuff that goes on here. One of my very first memories was my dad holding a hot iron at my mom's face. He didn't burn her, but it was inches away. The next thing I know, we're going to my tia's house, you know, and spending the night there. I didn't know that that was active alcoholism. I didn't know that my dad was drunk and he was in a rage. Mom didn't know. My mom, when she was 2 years old, was given to my aunt because her parents were having another child. And that's also kind of like what you did in back then in the family. You know, the oldest child was often given to another relative who might be alone or who had lost someone. You know, and they needed the help. They shouldn't be lonely. And so my mother was raised. So my mother didn't know anything about alcoholism. My tia, my aunt, did not drink. There was no drinking in that house. I mean, what you had in that house was you had church, you had God, you had going to work, and you slept, and that was it, you know? And I don't know how much attention and affection and love my mom got. And I can tell you that I don't think my dad got much either, because my dad wouldn't talk about it. You know, like, probably my husband worked with my dad after my dad retired from the post office. You know, I bet you my dad, my husband has heard more stories of my father than what my father would share with me. Everything he lived with was secret and pretty hush-hush. There's two stories I remember my dad told. One was when there was some vecino, some neighbor in the outhouse, and it was sitting on top of a hill, it was on a cliff, and they set the outhouse on fire and set it rolling down the hill. That was one story that my dad told. And then the other story my dad would tell was living in Powake. My grandpa, he had this huge, huge garden. And he said, my dad said, we grew up in the Depression, but we didn't know that anybody was starving because we always had food. We grew our food, and because we grew our food, we could always trade for anything that we needed. So they also had these, my grandpa also planted these orchards. And where we live right now, we still have some of those trees that were planted way back when in the early 1900s. And so there was a bus that my dad would tell this story of that would start in the southern part of the state of New Mexico in Las Cruces and would go all the way up to Denver, Colorado. And the bus driver would stop in our little place, in our little village, Powake, and he would pick up some full bottles of moonshine and drop off the empties. And then on the way back from coming back from Denver, Colorado, stop there, and the reverse would happen. And my dad would say everybody in the valley would get busted, except for my dad. He had this good working relationship with the sheriffs and everybody, you know. And I can imagine there was probably a little payment on the side, you know. But those were the two stories that I remember my dad telling. But there wasn't much else of that. And I don't even know why I'm telling this. I My dad's drinking wasn't all the time that I knew, because I didn't go to work with him. But I will tell you that when my dad's day off came after working those 5 days, that was the day that he got drunk. If he worked from Tuesday through Sunday, Monday, my dad would always have dinner on the table when we got home. And it was a pretty good dinner. And we'd sit down to dinner. But before we were even halfway through, my dad's face would be in his plate because he was already so drunk. And we had that every once in a while. My brother, who was 5 years younger than I, we would look at each other and we would burst out laughing. And it wasn't like laughter like something was funny. It was that uncomfortable laughter, you know, just to try and break the tension. And when we did laugh, you know, it was like, you better be careful because you were going to get it if you did. And so what I learned was to keep my mouth shut. You don't talk. And you couldn't trust what anybody said. Because if you told them, well, what about when this happened? They would say, that didn't happen. Or if you said, I feel a certain way, they would say, no, uh-uh. You shouldn't feel like that because there's nothing wrong. Don't feel like that. You don't need to feel like that. So I learned to not trust myself. I learned to not trust the feelings that were deep within me, and I learned to just not trust what I even thought. And so before I know it, I didn't have any sense of trust of myself. And there was a part of me that didn't trust my parents. I didn't know what to trust in this world. I felt absolutely lost. I felt like I was a child by myself. And I didn't know what was wrong. I had no idea what was wrong. And what I started doing was I started to try to make the family okay. I began to be that kid who would take care of the laundry, who on Saturday mornings would get up and clean the house just to try and make everything okay so that everyone would be happy, so that everything would be at peace, so that maybe there'd be no fight, so that maybe my mom wouldn't be crying in her room. Because when my mom was crying in her room, what I had to do as a small child, nobody told me I had to do this, but it's what I did. I went to her and I put my arms around her and I'd pat her back and I'd say, it's okay, Mama. It's okay. Everything's okay. Don't cry. It became my job to make my mother okay. It became my job. And nobody gave this to me. I made it my job to make Mom's feelings okay. And you know what? I could never make Mom's feelings okay. I failed. I was consistently failing. I didn't know alcoholism. I didn't know alcoholism for the alcoholic, and I didn't know alcoholism for the family. I was absolutely clueless. No idea of any of it. No idea. I tell you. So, I was a senior in high school. I found myself pregnant. And back in 1970, 71, I found myself pregnant in 70. I didn't know anything else to do but to get married. And I remember waking up that morning of my wedding day. And my first thought when I woke up was, this is a bad idea. But everybody had been invited. The church services had been arranged. The priest had already been scheduled. The aunts and uncles had made all the tortillas and the potato salad, the enchiladas and the pozole. You know how it is. You know, all the aunts and uncles do all the preparations for it. So I couldn't say no. I couldn't say I changed my mind. And I don't know if my mom and dad would have even supported me if I changed my mind. But I, within me, didn't feel like I could change my mind. And I knew it was a bad idea. I knew it. I knew it. But once you made your bed, you got to lay in it. You know, you just got to follow through no matter what. Well, that young man and myself were divorced about three and a half years later. And we had this beautiful daughter who I couldn't raise. I was 17 years old having a child. I had no idea at the age of 17 how to be a mother. And my mom raised her because I couldn't. Because I did, you know what I did? I followed this guy I'd been married to, and I had to do whatever he wanted to do, and my mother was the one who took care of my kid. And what happened after we divorced? I changed, right? No, I didn't change. I did the same thing. I went out, and my mother continued to take care of this child. And I was out at the bars, happy hour, man. And you know who I ended up with? The drunkest one. I always ended up with the drunkest one. I have a friend who says, yeah, you grab them who's the drunkest one as they're falling off the bar stool because you know they're not going to say no. And that's how little self-esteem I had within myself. I didn't think that I could attract a man who was stand up, a man who had self-worth, a man who had self-esteem, a man with a good job, because there was nothing to me. I didn't amount to anything. I didn't mean anything. I was valueless. I was not important. I thought the only way I could ever have a man in my life was if he needed me. Now, I couldn't have told you that. I didn't know that at the time. In doing inventory after getting here, that's where I figured it out. That's where I found it out. That was the truth. I thought I had to be needed in order to have a relationship with a man, because a man who was a self-made stand-up man would want nothing to do with someone like me, because I didn't count. I didn't count. I was in and out of relationships for several years. And then shortly before I turned 24, I was invited to a wedding. And at this wedding, there was this guy standing outside the church, and he looked pretty good. He looked pretty different from all the guys I'd been dating and hanging out with. He was dressed in these, you know, light beige corduroy pants and had a Madras shirt on. He was combed and, you know, nice. I mean, he looked good. And I thought, this guy looks different from all the guys I've been hanging around with. And, you know, I kept my eye on him. And at the reception, all of a sudden, there's the buffet table, and he's on one side and I'm on one side, and I flash him this huge smile. I mean, I just gave this guy the biggest smile in the world. I mean, you know how we do? We put everything we have into it, you know? I mean, it comes from the tips of our toes all the way up, and it just like, we're like a light bulb, you know? Yeah, you get it. Yeah. It just, it has everything, you know? It's like, yeah, you know. And the poor guy, he had no idea what to do with that. He was like a deer in the headlights. His eyes got this big, and he didn't even smile back or anything. And he just like kept moving. I must have scared the living daylights out of him because he just kept moving. But I went and I sat with him, and I found out that day all the places that he liked to hang out. He told me which were bars, go figure. And so for the next several weeks, I showed up at every one of those bars. And after several times of us meeting at these bars and hanging out, one day he finally said to me, you know, I've known members of your family, we've had the same friends, and we've never met. And since we've met, we've ended up at all these places at the same time. He said, it must be fate. And I said, it must be fate. It really must be. I mean, come on. I was, what do we call him? Stalker. That's the only word you have. I was a stalker, man. I had my eyes set on this guy. And I was after, he He had what I want, and I was willing to go to any lengths, let me tell you. From the minute I saw him in the back, at the outside of that church. A year later, we were married. And into that relationship, he brought two boys who were 5 and 7. And I brought my daughter, who was 6. And shortly after, almost a year later, we brought another daughter into that family. And so we had yours, mine, and ours. And we really were yours, mine, and ours. We were not the Brady Bunch. We were not the Brady Bunch. There was nothing Brady Bunch or anything about that. We were literally people going our separate ways. We were like each individual in their own bubble. And every once in a while, the bubble would bump into another bubble. You know, but that was, there was no communication. There was very little contact. And our kids, especially our three oldest kids, they bonded together and they joined together. And they became so close. It was amazing. And they looked like each other. They had blonde hair and they had light eyes. And they would ask me when I was with them, are you babysitting? And it got easier finally for me to say, yes, I'm babysitting, because they looked nothing like me. Our youngest daughter has dark hair, but she's got these incredibly blue eyes, you know. And these kids are already older now. They're in their mid-40s, the oldest one, and our youngest daughter is now 38. And those kids, well, you know what happens when you have kids? They marry other people's kids. And then they all end up having more kids. You know what I'm saying? And before you know it, you think, oh, I've been in Al-Anon for so many years. It's nice and quiet. It's nice and calm. But I always say that the family disease of alcoholism, and alcoholism for the drinking person, is the gift that keeps on giving. It never stops. You know, and so Tom and I had been married for about 9 years, and it was not fun. It was not fun. My sponsor has this saying. She says, if they kick the dog before you get married, they're going to kick the dog after. Nothing in our family changed. In fact, everything got worse. And I really believe that when Tom and I got together, we really wanted something good. We really wanted to be happy. I don't think anybody gets married or gets into a relationship thinking, this is going to be bad. Woo! I can hardly wait, you know? Or it's like, I'm going to make their life miserable, and I'm going to show up for a miserable life myself. I don't think anybody does that. We really have these incredible hopes. I had these incredible hopes. I wanted a good, kind, caring, loving family. But I didn't have any tools for that. I had no tools for a caring, kind, loving family. And I don't know what anybody thinks about this talk, if they even hear it, but I'm, because who knows? They're like, let's get out of here. or get me a drink, you know? Oh, my Lord, it's hot in here. Okay, so it was not fun in our family. We had violence in our family. And it was the same thing. It was like what was in my family growing up, we repeated. Because that's all we knew. That's all we knew. We didn't talk. We had no relationship. We were ships passing in the night. I got to the place where my kids couldn't trust me. What I often say is that, you know, my kids would come to me and I think I was full of love for them. You know, and I would have an interaction with Tom, and the anger and the fear and the anxiety would kick in. And it's like turning on a faucet. It's like this one has the hot water. This one has the cold water. And it's like, here come my kids. Oh, here's the hot water full of love and care and compassion. But here's this interaction with Tom, and here comes the cold water full of anger, resentment, frustration, guilt, anxiety. And none of them are ever like, I come to my kids and it's tepid. The water's tepid. I can never give my kids all the love that I want to give them because it's not there. It's too mixed with this anger, this guilt, this frustration, this sense of like desperation, this sense of hopelessness. By the time I got to Al-Anon, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd think, oh, I can't do this day. I can't do this. I don't want to do this day. I wish I could just go up and smoke. like I didn't even exist. And it wasn't that I wanted to commit suicide. I was never suicidal. I just wished I wasn't existing in the world. And at the end of the day, it would be, thank God this day is over. Because I was surviving. I was just surviving. Every day was about surviving. Every single day, every single moment. And if you had asked me at those days, what's the most important thing in your life? I would have said, my children. My children are the most important things in my life. And I really believed it. I believed that that was the truth. But if you looked at me, you would have seen that it wasn't my children. Because like when all is said and done, more is said than done. I was saying these things, but I wasn't acting like that. That was not my behavior. My behavior was all my energy, all my focus, all my thought, my obsession was the alcoholic. That was my life. My children came second. The alcoholic was first in everything I did and in every thought I had. It was never my kids, never my children. And I would think that that's probably what my mother went through as well. You know, a couple of years before my father died, my mother was talking to me. She was never happy with my dad. I mean, she was always angry at my dad. And a couple of years before my dad died, she said, you know, she said, your father said something to me before you were born. She says, and she said, you know, he said to me, I don't think that's my child. You see, my dad had an eighth grade education. He didn't think he mattered. He didn't think that there was much value to him. And my mother had, she went through high school. And my mother had this incredible great job with the state. She was the district court clerk for the county of Santa Fe. And my dad did construction. And after he did construction for I was about 6 years old, maybe 7 years old, then my father went and worked for the federal government. And he was a maintenance man at the post office and a security guard, you know, for three of the buildings at the for the federal government. And I really thought I had the wrong dad. I really thought I had the wrong dad. And where was I? I was going somewhere with this and I just lost it. I heard the little squeaks back there and it just went pshoo! So it'll come back or it won't. I don't know. So I don't know. It's gone. Anyway, so give me a second. God will kick in a moment. Just hold on. Well, I'll just go on a little bit. God will kick in at some point. And just hold on, because it'll kick in, even if it's like 3 minutes before this talk is finished. So just bear with me. So this has never happened to me before. I can't believe this. I've always got something to say. Oh, thank you, Tom. I knew you'd help me. It's only trying to help, I know. So the children, I, you know, the way I behaved was not that my children were the most important. You know, they couldn't have been, because if they were the most important, I wouldn't have stayed there. I would have valued them enough that I would have done something different. But it was the best I could do, and I'm sure it was the best I could do. It came to me. My mother said to me, your dad thought it wasn't, you weren't his child. And she said, and when I was pregnant with your brother, he said to me, I don't think that's my child. My mother was this gorgeous woman. She was tall. She was statuesque. She was a beauty. And my dad, with his eighth grade education, didn't think he deserved a woman like her. And he was jealous. She'd go off on these business trips with these attorneys and with these judges. And he was afraid he was going to lose her because he wasn't enough. Jealousy became a family value in my family. And I'm not talking about a good family value, but it was a family value. And it was a family value that I picked up and then I used, because I became a very jealous person because I wasn't enough. Because I wasn't enough. When Tom finally got sober, he went into treatment. And at the treatment center, when I took him in, they said, "You have got to go to Al-Anon." They said, "In fact, if you don't get to at least 3 Al-Anon meetings, we won't let him out." Sounds good to me. I've been trying to get rid of this guy for a long time, you know, and if that's what it takes, that's all it takes, great. I have no idea what Al-Anon is anyway. You see, I would kick him out, and I'd always take him back. And if he didn't call me to beg to come back, I would go find him. And the day came when he said to me, "Juan, I see how miserable I'm making you. I see how miserable I'm making the kids. I'll leave." And I say, "You can't go. You can't go," because he was everything I had. I did not know how to exist in my life without him. I didn't know how to be alone. I had no idea. We used to go to restaurants and I wouldn't order a drink. And he'd order a drink and I would drink it. And I couldn't figure out why at the end of the night he was drunk when I drank his drinks. It wasn't until he got sober that I realized he was stopping off at the bar on his way to the men's room and getting a couple of double shots on his way there and on his way back. I just thought, this guy is, he really is bad. And I don't know what's wrong with him, but he's bad in every way. But I'd already had one failed marriage. You can't fail at another one, because then you really are a loser. You know, you're really a loser. And I just couldn't have that. So I had to stick with it. So they said, "Go to Al-Anon." Oh my God. I remember going to where the Al-Anon meeting was, and I drove by and I cruised by. I'm a stalker, remember? So I know how to go very slowly, keep my eyes on the road and still look. I don't know about you, but growing up in a family and having active alcoholism in my life, I learned how to be super hyper vigilant. I know everything that is going on around me. Down there, over there. I mean, my ears hear everything, my eyes see everything. I mean, I am hyper aware. I know it all. So I'm driving to this meeting and I'm looking as I'm driving, I'm going, "I ain't going in there. I don't want to go in there." I saw people going into this place that looked dark and it looked like a basement. I thought, "I don't want to go in there." I drove around the block and went back to work. And that next Saturday, which was a week after I'd taken him into treatment, I had to go to Family Day. And when I got to Family Day, they asked me, "Have you gone to Al-Anon?" And I said, "No." And they said, "You really have to go to Al-Anon." And I went to Al-Anon the next week, not because I thought I needed it, not because I wanted it. I went to Al-Anon because I had to look like the kind, caring, loving, supporting wife that I wasn't. I was not a loving, caring, kind, supporting wife. But I wanted to show them that I was. It was about, how will they view me? How will they at the treatment center see me? They had to see me as being okay. They had to see me as the person who was not the problem. He was the problem. And I went to this Al-Anon meeting and I knew no one there could help me. They were a bunch of housewives. They were a bunch of old hippies. They were a bunch of professional women and men who were dressed very nice. And I knew none of them had the problem that I had in my life. None of them did. I'd gone to work and told them about an incident that happened in my home, and their eyes got this big and their jaws dropped to their chest. And I knew, one more time, you blew it. You talked about something that you should not have talked about. How could you be so stupid to talk about this stuff? Never again. And these people I knew were like them. And they won't get it. They don't get it. But I went in because I'm going to go to Family Day and they're going to hear and they're going to see that I'm that loving, caring, supportive wife. they talked about God. And I thought, you guys are pathetic. You are so pathetic. God did nothing for me, and God does nothing for you, and God doesn't care about anybody. In fact, there is no God. I don't know why I'm here or why they wanted me to come, but I stayed. I stayed. And finally, a woman asked what I thought was the most important question. She said, how do I get my husband into treatment? And I thought, finally, someone has asked the million-dollar question. She quit talking and nobody answered her. So I raised my hand. And I say, Al-Anon made its first mistake because they called on me. And I proceeded to tell her and everybody else there how to get their husband into treatment. Because I thought I'd done it. I thought I had gotten my husband into treatment. Because we had had the conversation. You know, the conversation. Out of how many conversations had we had? I forgot that one morning when we had that conversation, I'd woken up from a dream. And in that dream, there's this guy climbing out of the gutter, and the gutter gets deeper and deeper, and he's dirty, and he's greasy, and he's a mess, and he's filthy. And as I wake up and I'm watching this, and I'm watching this man struggle to get out of the gutter, I realize that's my husband. And my next thought was, if that's him, what does this say about you? And somewhere within me, there was a conversation that began to what, to who, where, I don't know. But I know that what happened was I thought to myself, what am I going to say? I've said everything in the world that I can possibly say. I've done everything I can possibly do. None of it has made a difference. And my next thought was, pray to God. And I said, okay, God, a God that I didn't believe in. A God that I was trying to convince myself did not exist. I said, God, if I talk to him, what are the words that I'm going to use? What am I going to say? I think that's step two, one, two, and three, just like that. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And I never asked for help. I never asked anybody for help because that's not what you do. That's not what I did. I can handle this. I can handle everything. There is nothing I cannot do. But here, in that moment, give me the words. And we had that conversation, and because we had that conversation and he went into treatment, I thought I had done it. I didn't know that he was sick and tired of living the way he was living. I had no idea he'd reached his limit. He had gotten that gift of desperation. And he went into treatment. Well, after I finished sharing my incredible knowledge of how to get him into treatment, and I said, thank you, or what? Who knows what I said, you know? I mean, that was almost 31 years ago. You know, but what they all said at the meeting is what we always hear at just about every meeting we go to. They said, thank you for sharing. Keep coming back. And in my arrogance, I think very little of myself, but I am so incredibly arrogant that I thought, you value my experience, you value my knowledge. You understand that I've been to a family day and I've got information that will benefit you. I will keep coming back because you poor, pathetic, pitiful people, ready for this? Need me. I stayed in Al-Anon for all the wrong reasons. All the wrong. I went to Al-Anon for the wrong reasons. I stayed in Al-Anon for the wrong reason. Several months later, I heard this conversation between Tom and another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and please tell me when I've got to wrap it up. Start wrapping it up? Sure. Holy moly. Okay, so he said to this person, you know, so-and-so's what? Divorcing his wife? Oh, my God. I thought they were so in love, and now that they were sober, everything was wonderful. What? Now I'm only hearing his side. And it's like, what? She wouldn't go to Al-Anon and she was crazy? His sobriety was more important than being with her? Oh, and I heard this, and I thought, I'll keep going to Al-Anon. But I didn't intend to get this. I was only going to go and pick up the slogans so that I could keep him. I was going to pick up the lingo so it looked like I was doing something to keep him. Everything I did was for the wrong reason. Everything. But I stayed. And I got a sponsor, and I worked those 12 steps. She took me through inventory. We sat down and we wrote inventory, and when I shared my fifth step with her, she said to me, oh my God, she says, you have become so incredibly human to me. She says, I loved you before, but I love you even more now. I love you even more now because you're so human and you're so precious to me. And I left her house and I felt like I was beginning to be cleansed. I felt like maybe I could begin to breathe. And when we got through 6 and 7, she says, I have not gone past, I have not even started step 8. She says, you need to find someone else. I went through 2 years of Al-Anon, not having a sponsor, and I got crazy. And I will tell you that I was active in service, and I was sponsoring people, and I was going to meetings on a consistent basis. 3 or 4 meetings every week, but I was getting crazier. You see, the disease does not stop. The disease does not end. The family disease for me is as progressive as alcoholism as a disease is progressive for the alcoholic. It is waiting, and it's waiting, and it's just waiting to get in there when you have this little slip. And because I was getting worse and worse, because I'm either moving towards the power and healing and health and balance and harmony, or I'm moving towards the disease and sickness and insanity. I'm never standing still. I'm either going one way or the other. And because I didn't have a sponsor and because I quit working these steps, I nearly took my family's life. And because there's not enough time to go into it, how do you wrap up 31 years in an hour or so? It's impossible. It's impossible. But I nearly took my family's life because I quit working the steps. And the steps are so important. The steps are what changed me. It wasn't going to meetings. Meetings gave me the idea that I wasn't alone. Meetings gave me the idea that there was fellowship, that there were people around me who I could turn to. The steps are what gave me a solid base. The steps are what gave me the ability to find out who I wasn't, who the disease of alcoholism, living with alcoholism every day, turned me into a person that God never intended me to be. By working those 12 steps, I found out who I was by finding out who I wasn't. And as I found out who I was, God gave me the courage to find another woman who has been my sponsor now for 25, 26 years. And she has walked with me through those years and has helped me grow in my healing and has helped my connection with the God of my understanding grow stronger and stronger and stronger. And I didn't know that it was that connection with the power that I so desperately needed and that I so desperately craved. I had no idea. I thought I just wanted enough money to buy just beans and to make some tortillas and to fry some potatoes so that I could feed my family. I thought that I just needed enough money so that I could pay the car insurance. If I had gotten that, I would have been so happy. And I would have settled with that. But the steps led me to a God. And led, because of this God, changed my relationships with my husband, with my children, with my parents. Gave me the strength that when my dad was dying from cancer, gave me the ability to sit with him and to walk with him and to help him move from this life to the next. The person who first came here into this program could never have done that because I was too selfish. I was too scared. I was so scared I didn't even dare admit to myself that I was scared. Couldn't admit it. Gave me the power to walk through my mother's dementia. I couldn't have done that. Has given me the power to sit with sponsees. And when you're in this program, you grow so close to those people you sponsor. They become family. and you care about them so deeply, and I've had to say goodbye to several of them because of illnesses, and I've sat with them and walked with them and wished them well on their journey to the next world. I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I had the strength for that. And you all know, it wasn't my strength. None of it was my strength. I needed my strength from you. I needed my strength from the God of my understanding. And that's what this program has given me. And it's changed me. It's changed me so much. I'm not recognizable to myself when I look back at the woman I was when I walked in July 2nd of 1986 into that friendship club in Santa Fe at Alta Vista, which is not there. It hasn't been there for a long time. It's now a Taco Bell, I think. I am nothing like that woman. You see, today, I had the courage to say to the God of my understanding, just open my heart, open my spirit, and open my mind to you. And I don't know how open and vulnerable I've been to you, because there's that part of me that is still a little bit scared. But I will tell you that I am honest with you, and I'm authentic, and that I'm real, and I'm not afraid to be who I am today, and I am proud of the woman that God has turned me into, and I never thought that I could have stood before anybody and said that. And I thank you for that. I thank Al-Anon for that, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, all of you showing up to support this weekend, because this is so important. And I hope that many of you sign up to help next year so that we can have this and have it be the second annual Al-Anon Native American Conference. Because we need you. Doesn't matter if you're Native, doesn't matter if you're Hispanic, doesn't matter if you're Irish, doesn't matter if you're German, doesn't matter if you're African, doesn't matter if you're Chinese. Those are just God suits, as my friend Don says. They're just God suits. We're all just God's children in different God suits. Let's show up. Let's do this together. Haven't we fought the disease of alcoholism enough in our own families, with the alcoholics and with ourselves? Let's not fight and be separate. Please, I beg of you, with everything I have in me, join together. Let's be brothers and sisters. Let's be brothers and sisters and come together to carry a message of strength, a message of hope, that it is possible to recover, that it's possible to be happy, no matter if the alcoholic is drinking, no matter what's going on with those people we love that we can't change. Let's come next year. Thank you for having me.